I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined by driver coach, musician, former racing driver, and general knowledge expert, Rob Wilson.
Ed, hello.
A very, very warm welcome. Thank you so much for coming down to a very bright and sunny Woodcote Park. We could hear the lawnmower outside, but that's left us for now. But we've got a really fun hour ahead of us. We've got loads of readers' questions. Karun Chantok actually called me up specifically to ply me with questions. So hopefully we can answer as many of those as possible. For those of you that sort of don't know, I actually printed off a few of the series that you raced in.
Oh, right.
I'm not going to read them all because we'll be here for 2 hours. But yes. Just starting sort of, let's start at the top. We've got Dubai 24 Hours, FIA GT3 European Championship, American Le Mans Series, 24 Hours of Le Mans Series, American Le Mans Series again, British GT Championship, FIA GT Championship, IndyCar Series, NASCAR Busch Series, Busch East Series, and that's only back to 91, and it goes back to 1975. So,
you know, I couldn't have come up with that list, and I think I sort of almost stopped racing at the end of 1980. You know,
I have to say the stats tell a very different story.
I must have been there.
Yeah. And then those that are sort of wondering about the musician part, if they Google Edison Lighthouse, "Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes." That's you on the bass, is it?
Well, not on that recording. It's a very small part of, like, all we were doing. We were with this agency who had a series of one-hit wonder groups. So we would all be sitting just off Oxford Street near Dick James, the manager who had Tom Jones and Engelbert Humperdinck. And we were in the next sort of office. And we'd sit there with, and someone would say, "Oh, the Swinging Blue Jeans need a bass player this night," or and Desmond Decker, with the Israelites chap, would be sitting around there all day waiting to get gigs and waiting to get paid. And it was one of those very early 70s one-hit wonder type organizations. So you would find yourself in and out of different groups. Johnny Wakelin and the Kinshasa band, they had Inzaire, Muhammad Ali. And he would be there, and he had some hit records, like Muhammad Ali got to number 3, Inzaire was a big hit, but he could only ever write songs about boxes, and he came over as this sort of rather all black boxes, fairly trendy stuff. He was actually a one-legged guy from Brighton, and he would be sitting there, and jobs would come in. And you would go off. So that's all that was.
Right. Okay. Well, and then, as I mentioned in the, you know, in the intro, you know, what you're sort of best known for is the instruction. And you've had, you know, for F1 alone, you've had Bottas, Raikkonen, you know, all the big names. Whether it's not just Formula One, there's sports cars, even rallying.
Yes.
So, in a sort of as brief a summary as possible, what is it that they come to learn from you specifically? Because I came along, but you'll explain it much better than me.
Well, it all comes down to the same thing. It's your relationship with the surface. It's the rate you move your body, the rate you transfer weight. That's at least the icing on the cake. So when we get everything else done, that this line, the other thing, we bring it back to this rate of weight transfer with your feet and your hands. You drive the car as much with your feet as you do with your hands. So when we're coming up to a corner, say we're going to steer the car to the corner, I'll say, "Well, turn now." And you'll go, "Well, I don't want to turn now." But we don't mean that biggish turn. It's just the subtlest of tiny turns. And it's the same as when you get a sidecar passenger on a motorbike, or they sit on the back and they race them. They come to a corner. Before they get to the corner, the guy in the back's already leaning over and where he wants to get to, because that's where they want the weight. But, and that's what we've got to do with the steering of the car, except it's hidden when you're in the car. You don't see it from the outside, and but it makes a huge difference, shortens the corner up enormously. So that part of it is very important. Same with the braking. Introduce the car to the brake pedal so that you don't go bang on the brakes. Because it doesn't matter how well they build the car, although the F1s are pretty close at it now, the rear brakes always get the message a bit later than the fronts. So if you go bang on the brakes and down goes the nose, up comes the rear, and then it gets its full brake pressure, of course, you don't get the maximum out of the rear. So you introduce it. And so before the nose has gone down, meaning before the rear's come up, you've got that full pressure, and you get this little parachute effect at the back there. But you are staring death in the face, and so you need to separate the fear from the feel. You think, I'm coming up to this barrier here, or my teammate's going to outbrake me and ruin my career. And you've got to brake late, but it's important that you move your body in the same way. Getting them to do that, that's not easy. Yeah. You have to do it 100 times over.
Yeah. And I seem to remember, in terms of the actual sort of corner line itself, it's a case of actually making the corner a lot shorter than it mm-hmm. than it was previously.
Yes.
So it's a case of just getting the car round it and straight.
Yes, that's
as
right.
As quickly as possible, rather than the really sort of smooth
yes.
line.
That's right. If we go to a racing school, or someone, people will point out the most geometrically correct line, which is reasonable. You don't want people doing too many weird things when they first get into racing cars. So, but the geometrically perfect line does often mean that the corner goes on a little bit long. And so you may get a slightly higher minimum speed, but if that corner goes on a bit long, you've got a couple of degrees of tyre scrub or slip angle in the car, and the car's not going forward as much as you'd like it to be going forward. In the older days, skinny tyres made out of concrete, you needed to flick the nose in and hold this, and you'd hold this long four-wheel drift going around corners. But because the tyres are so skinny, the cars didn't go slower. They kept going forward. But the more modern tyres now, the gumball-type tyres, you get into a bit of a long drift. It looks beautiful. It's well-driven. You know the lap is over because it just stalls the car. So you look more now to sort of a block system of driving, where it's a bit more of a sharper turn somewhere in the middle of the corner or near the exit of the corner, so that you can get steering out of it.
It's for anyone who hasn't been to see Robert, you work sort of mostly out of Bruntingthorpe, and I love the thought of the likes of Kimi Räikkönen turning up to Bruntingthorpe, or even Valentino Rossi when he was doing the rally and driving around cones with you. Yes. I think it's absolutely wonderful. I'd love to just talk a little bit about Alonso and the Indy 500, because he's disqualified fifth.
Yes.
Which is a remarkable effort. What is it that is there something that separates top drivers like Alonso out from the merely sort of good drivers? Is there something that you've come across with someone like Räikkönen who?
Yes, but not so much at Indy. That will be down to the car setup. There's James Hinchcliffe, who had pole at Indy last year.
Yeah.
Who I train. He comes over and does days. He's 17th this year because the car didn't quite work. Now, if he was driving the same car and the same team in Formula One and he'd qualified, on pole at Silverstone last year and was 17th this year, there would be
big questions.
That's right. And so that's down to the car. So at Indy, he's with Andretti's. I know the Andretti team very well. Marco comes over and does his time, and his other teammates have been as well. But they've got a very good Indy setup there. They know how to go around Indy. The Honda engine and that aero package is working really well on the super speedways, which is what you would call Indy. So he's in a very good car. So it's more down to the setup there. I would have thought you could have taken most people out of the Formula One field, and they in that car they probably would have got there. I don't think that's particularly Alonso.
Right, okay, but then come the race, that's where the extra skill comes in, traffic.
That's right, the traffic, and when the air gets taken off you going to these corners. Now, Alonso is a brilliant driver, and of course we know when we see what he's doing in Formula One now, much less what he was doing before, he is extra special and as a driver. Whether he can use that in the race, that's another thing. If that car doesn't quite work, if it's got a little bit too much push, or if it's a little bit loose, a little bit tail happy in that corner, that problem goes on for a long time, all the way around turn three till you're out of turn four, and then all the way around turn one and turn two, and you can quickly find yourself moving back, because the problem, you don't come to a hairpin and you can muscle it around, and then you've got a flat out corner that everyone takes flat. You don't have that. It's like a man with a piece of string in the middle of the track, you know, staying in the middle of the track, and the car goes around and around like a circus ride going around there. If that's out, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And how did you find the speedways when you first tried one?
They were fine when I was doing it in Indy Lights, and then they were on the shorter ovals, and so Phoenix, Nazareth, those sort of places, and so there was 1 mile ovals roughly, and yes, you would get a bit of disturbance, but not to the extent that you'd get on the super speedways, and it's all completely about setup. You know, they're driving a really frightening car during qualifying at Indy. You could get to do 218 mile an hour, and it was absolutely scary. And I get into an AJ Foyt car, which actually hasn't done that well this year, but there goes around, suddenly it's 224 and it's easy. And so it's just like I don't know, like riding a bicycle on a slippery sidewalk. You know, you just got to, it's very, very delicate, but if that car works, it's easy. If it doesn't work, it's the most frightening thing in the world.
When you say easy, I don't think sort of easy enough for the general public to jump in. It's still, there is a challenge there. I know you're probably being very modest, but well, I think that it's not.
Yes, you're thinking, but you're feeling it. As long as it feels okay, because it's difficult for people to imagine when you're at Indy, you're lapping, doing a 2.5 mile lap in about 36 seconds. That's what you're doing. But you would look at the speedo on the dash as you exited turn four. You knew you had to read at least 213 mile an hour. On that to make this a good lap. You'd see 211 or 212 and you think, oh, that is really slow. It changes. It changes. You know, your perspective of what's fast changes.
Yeah. So just sort of rewinding a bit, what is it that, I mean, leaving India aside, what is it that separates the likes of Alonso to the kind of the good
lesser
drivers?
Yes. He has a fantastic feel for where the limit is, and he can just go that little bit over the limit and then bring it back. He's one of those sort of drivers. I think it's mostly in his feel that he's brilliant in the wet, he's brilliant when he's got to carry a car on his back, and I just think he knows he'll take that chance and he can deal with it, whereas a lot of people, if the car moves a little bit, they'll back away from it, and he just has a feel for the surface.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Andressis there. Am I right in thinking that Mario wants to come over and see you to see if he can find a few Ents in his two-seater Indy car?
Yes, it's quite funny that, because Marco has been coming over. He's qualified just behind Alonso this time. I think he's seventh, I think, on the grid. And he's a great natural driver, and we're getting him technically better. And he's been over quite a bit. And now, Mario apparently, or Marco says he's bringing him over next time, because Marco talks to Mario about what he's doing. And Mario's still at the age of, what, 76, 77?
I mean, still competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. He does these, very much so. And he does these drive arounds. So the people on the oval with a two seater IndyCar, and they sit in the back, and he's roaring around the speedway, and then now he's coming in and saying to Marco, oh, I just got the steering out of it by a fraction coming out of this corner. I picked up, 2 miles an hour doing that stuff, and he's talking about the stuff. So apparently Marco's dragging him over for the next day that we do, so that will be fun.
That'd be brilliant. Now, as I mentioned earlier, that Corinne called me up and gave me sort of lots of things to ask. We've got lots of other readers' questions as well, so we're gonna get to those. But he said, ask about the Nico Rosberg story.
This is the end of the championship story. We were at the Autosport Awards, and he got a big trophy there.
Yeah.
And then as he came off stage, I was at the sort of near the front of the stage on the left-hand side as we look at the stage, and Mercedes were on the right-hand side. But he came off of this trophy, and then he just came down and sat down, pulled up a chair, and sat there and just said, thank you, you know, we listened. And he goes, flat car.
And really?
It's something that he kept locked in his brain for, I don't know, since we started doing stuff with him there. And then he just sat down and chatted away very, very, very politely, very kindly during the Felipe Massa's retirement speech, which was not that long, the speech, but neither was Massa's retirement.
You know. No, exactly.
And,
yeah.
They chatted away, and it just seemed that the moment he stopped racing, he became this thoroughly warm, reasoned chap, you know, rather than he's quite intense, obviously, all the way through his racing, which you would be, you know. But that was a real surprise and very kind of him to just come down.
That's great. One of the things I was wondering, actually, on the way here was, as far as I know, you're the only person that sort of teaches these specific kind of, I don't know how to put it, but this specific technique.
Dynamics, I
suppose. Yeah, dynamics,
techniques.
Why, I mean, with the calibre of names that you've got coming through your school and what they say about you in terms of how brilliant it is, why aren't more people setting up shops on how to actually teach? I know they obviously wouldn't do the same job as you, but why isn't this technique more widely known?
That's a tough one, and I work with so many drivers, and I keep thinking, who could we pick out of this group that could take this on? Because, you know, I can't go on doing it forever, and the queue is so long doing it. So I do think that, and I think it's how you communicate with the people. You don't want to be instructing to show how fast you are. You don't want to be doing it in order to get a drive from a wealthy amateur. Well, people do, and that's fine, and that's fair, because they develop relationships and so on. But what I do is I make sure that person is the most important person in the world, and the only thing that matters is that they go forward 5 atoms, you know, an hour. And I learnt this way of thinking actually from David Robertson, who was Steve Robertson's dad, and we've been friends since the 80s. Now they put Jensen into Formula One, and Kimi, and David passed away very sadly now, was an East End boy made good, and he made a lot of money before he got into the management of racing drivers. And he would say to me back in the 80s, he would go, people say to me, Rob, they say, it must be great to be your own boss. And he goes, no, I'm not my own boss. Everyone's my boss. I've got 1,000 bosses. I make sure everyone gets what they want. And it was a good line, you know, and then out of that, of course, is a trickle-down effect. And that stays in my mind. Someone arrives, and they've come from Brazil, Argentina, Australia, just for 2 days, America, US. They're good guys. And the only thing that matters is them. Now, I know that would be common sense, but
a lot of people get it wrong.
So I think that then it's a matter of, well, how do you communicate? You've got to X-ray into the person. You've got to X-ray, and you're driving around, and you know in your blood when you're driving around, I think I know what the problem is here. We say techniques, and there's certain lines and bits and pieces, but there's that you can tell by their relationship, by the way they move their body. All right, this is going to be a longer job, it's going to be a shorter job, we can get on to other things now. So I'm not sure why people, I think they get used to you, and they know, you know, it's pretty safe, you know, we don't go doing a driver from one F1 team and then be telling secrets to another F1 team. Yeah. They seem to trust me.
It was very safe with me because I was about a minute off the pace, but you found seconds and seconds and seconds between my first lap and last.
You showed great promise.
Potential in another life.
There was a lot of room. No, there was
a lot of room for improvement.
No, there was great potential, and then your future life, which I think, you know, yeah, you'll be able to.
When I'm half the height I am, then I'll be perfect.
I think you're out Dan Gurney, don't you?
Exactly. Right. I did mention these readers' questions, so I'm just sort of picking these at random. This one's from Karim, who he's wondering whether you have any insights about Esteban Ocon. When he went to use your Vauxhall for training, how do you rate him as a driver? Because he's doing very well in the Force India at the moment.
He's doing very, very well. He's the right personality. He's got broad shoulders as a personality, which I think when you get into Force India, there are proper blokes in that team, and you need to be able to have broad shoulders in there, because they're a very practical team, and he's got that. And he's got a good humour about him. And then when it comes to the driving, he is fast. He'll be back again shortly. We're going to keep working on it. We can just get a little bit more rotation out of the car, and you know, we'll just see that the values just move on a little bit. But he's just a good, very, very fast driver. Thoroughly deserves that drive, and he's only going to get better. We like him very much.
Do you, with any of your pupils, do you ever get to a stage where you think, you know what, I actually can't teach you anything else, or is there always something that you can tweak, improve on?
People understand what you want them to do, and they see it on the stopwatch. Then when they are lapping, the people who do a lot of days, many, many days, and it becomes a little bit of a battle where just near enough is not good enough. So we've got all of the things, but it's amazing how you need to keep reminding and working and going, no, that was just a little bit too hard on the brakes there. The car didn't change direction. Forget the lap. You know, we get down to a lovely guy, Artem Markolov. He's won the Bahrain GP2, or yeah, Formula 2 now. And we do a lot of days with him. And we battle it out, and we just get like, you know, we know the lap's going to be a tenth off because the car went on a bit long. We abandon the lap. So you get to a point where you just keep going over, and also things change. You start to highlight different things. I'm trying to think of who I was talking. Oh, Luca Giotto is his teammate, and again, very, very talented. Came second the last race at Barcelona, and there was a few joins you could feel in his inputs. You know, you can feel these little energy spikes going on for a while. And then after a day or two, they went away. And we got this lovely feel there the other day, which thought, this is really good. Except the corners were going on a little bit long. So once all the other stuff had been taken out of the way, the other little problems become clear. They become clearer. And so now the next time he's back, we'll be shortening those corners up a little bit. When that happens, we may find that maybe the throttle applications are a bit too sudden or something. You never know.
Yeah, it's a never-ending story.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So certainly with someone like
me. Well, I think Stirling Moss said it, didn't he? He said, you never get that perfect lap. He'd say when he was winning Monaco, I was reading it just last week. He said, right, I'm going to make this a qualifying lap, you know, while he's leading the 61 Monaco Grand Prix. Yeah, yeah. And then something would just go slightly wrong, so you start again, and that's what we do.
Yeah, and he was saying that I think he then reset the lap, not necessarily on the start-finish line, but whatever corner he was on.
From this point forward. And long distance races were great for this. You know, I used to go around, you were running around in Dubai or Le Mans, Daytona, and you would be practicing all this stuff, and you'd just think, oh, that corner went a bit long, you idiot. And then for sure as eggs don't bounce, it's 2/10 slower on that lap, and then you put it right in the next lap.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to keep trying to find some readers' questions. We've got so many of them.
Sorry.
I'm going to get no, not at all. I've got so many that I'm going to get in trouble if I don't ask me. So there's one here from DR. It's like others, I have heard various reports as to the results of your initial evaluations of some current F1 drivers, especially Kimi and Lewis. Could you please confirm the following is correct? Kimi passed with flying colours, although technically he failed as he clipped a cone. And then you sent Lewis on his way with a comment that there was nothing you could teach him.
No. I don't remember Lewis being there.
Right.
There was absolutely nothing that you could have taught Lewis. I mean, he is just such a great driver, and so I don't recall that. Kimi claims that it was me who hit the cone, you know.
Right.
and yeah, I did, but that wasn't
from
on the fastest
seat.
Lap. Yeah, I don't know how I could see that. But I know it was he who did it. But anyway, so there's still a dispute going on. He's going to come and put that right soon, I think.
And with because Kimi, I think the general view of Kimi is that he's very, very sort of quiet and doesn't say much, but I think actually when he's away from a racetrack, he's a much more lively character.
Oh, he's got a great black sense of humour. He's quite funny. I find him quite funny, and just amongst people that he knows, I think he's and also, you know, he hasn't forgotten where he came from. You know, I remember talking to him back at the in the very early days, and David and Robertson had helped them out, and Steve Robertson. You know, obviously they were taking care of everything. And I did say to him, you remember where this came from, won't you? And he goes, I will remember. He didn't need me to tell him. You know, when he started making money, the first thing he did was make sure that the parents had their house. He's got friends in Finland. He helps them out with their businesses and bits and pieces. He's one of the good guys.
Yeah. It's actually very rare that you hear about a lot of the good stuff that the Formula One drivers do. And obviously, I suppose the latest one that everyone did hear about was Jensen giving so much to Billy Munger. That was in the news. But they, you know, I think there's sometimes quite a sort of a negative view of these F1 drivers, because you do, the, we don't have the full picture. But actually, I think you know, most of them are all pretty decent people.
Most of them are, you know. And I heard Damon Hill saying it on TV. You know, racing drivers are nice people. They're nice people, except when you know, if you step on their toes, you know, and then you know that's different. But then yeah. They're racing, but they are nice people. Yeah.
Right, we got one from here to hear from Diego Ruiz. He says, "Have you ever learned something noteworthy or had any particular insight from your pupils?"
I think you're always doing that, because it'll be a phrase they'll come up with. You know, we're lapping, we're doing 100 laps up there, and they'll do something, and you'll think, that gave it a slightly better exit, and it'll be just the way they do it. But yes, I think you're always absorbing it. You know, I've been doing it 30 years, and so and some of the best drivers in the world, so you are sitting there, you can't help but learn or study, because they're doing most of the laps. I only do a couple of laps in the morning, maybe a couple in the afternoon, just to set a lap time. And that you're articulating it all the time and having to solve those problems, it means you're thinking about it more. You have to make sense to them as well. And so it's hard to think of a one particular thing that you've actually learnt from a driver, but you've observed, say, Kimi, was very good at the rate of input on the throttle. You know, just as the weight's coming down on the car, you know, it's been coming a bit more flat, and the throttle goes down at the same rate as the weight's coming down. And he was very good like that during the traction control era, because he would just feed it in and not use up as much traction control as Montoya would, who would go bup, 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 and Kimi would not use it as much. And that he saved a bit of fuel doing that, because I think the fuel still... it spits out when the traction control is working. So, so you'll keep that in mind. You know, you might be trying to introduce it, but you'll keep that feel in mind and try and introduce it to other people. And Kimi was a good example of that.
Yeah. What do you think happened to Kimi sort of recently in his sort of his second Ferrari career? Because when he came back to F1 after the World Rally Championship, he was, you know, into Lotus, or the sort of new incarnation of Lotus, yeah. And was. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But then he's shaded quite heavily, certainly this year, against Vettel. And I think a lot of people say he's got very specific demands on the setup of the car. And if the car isn't quite where he needs, a bit like Button.
Yes, he's a bit more broader based than Button. But he likes the car to follow its nose. And a bit in the same way that Nigel Mansell was in there, that if the car would follow its nose... into the first half of the corner, then he was fine. But that really depends on the setup of the car. And once the car follows its nose, and he's good, and maybe he still wants to find it. I think he can do it with this car. I think the reason he hasn't out-qualified Vettel more are just little mistakes he's making. You know, he overdid it on the exit of the last corner. He tried to make it up, at Bahrain. And it's actually a mistake rather than the ability to just go fast. And he will know that. And he will start to hopefully reduce his mistakes pretty soon. Yeah. And also, his corners are going on a fraction long again. He used to manipulate the direction change. He used to rotate the car a little bit more previously. And now he's carrying a lot more corner entry speed. But then the exit of the corner is going on a little bit long. Just looking at it from the armchair.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're focused on the actual driving technique. But is some of the teaching a mental barrier you have to get through with some drivers? Is it a sort of sometimes more of a mental problem than an actual technique problem?
I find that once you get the technique right, the mental problem goes away. It's once you show them. How? If you move your body like this, if you look at where you want to get to there, if you wait for the car to rotate, if you sit on this side of the track instead of that side of the track, the lap times come down, and then I think the mental problems go away.
Right, we've got another one from Diego, actually. He was just asking about whether you'd like to have gone to F1 in the 80s and whether you would have enjoyed it or not. I think it's probably a yes and a yes, isn't it?
I would think so. You know, the nearest we truly got was being bought out of the Belgium Grand Prix drive in 81 by Alboreto. Because I was entering the race and had the super license and Ken Turrell, who'd found his way through to me on landlines in those days, you know, and he somehow, and I think he talked to Ron Turnak. It was at at Ralt by then, not Brabham, but Ralt. And so we're in Ken's, okay, now the only thing that can go wrong here is that Val Beretta comes down with all this money and buys this drive. You know, and I think on the Wednesday before the race, Count Zanon, who was a backer of Val Beretta, paid for his wages at Ferrari as well, came down the pit lane and bought the drive. And that was, so that was as close as it probably got. There was one or two others, the Fittipaldi one, earlier that year, but they sold the drive for the opening round to, I think, Chico Serra. But I was signed up there at Fittipaldi, right. And that was a few months before. And so those things. But then I had a very simpleton view of motor racing. I thought if you did okay in the lower classes, you know, the F3s and bits and pieces, you got your super license and people took you on as a racing driver. But it hadn't factored in then that money was playing a part. We think of it now, but it was also doing it then.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in, you've we mentioned in the intro to how many championships you've driven in. Do you, was there a specific type of car that you loved driving? Was there anything that kind of from these, you know, all these decades that you think back and think, you know what, that was actually a pretty perfect car for?
There are two cars that stand out, and one was the Ralt RT3 Formula 3 car. I got the first win for one of those,
yeah.
And I'd worked very closely with Ron Turnack, from whom I learnt a great deal and still admire. And he's still alive out in Sydney. And we worked and worked, and that car finally became the best car in the field. And by the time that I'd got out of it, it was a really good car, and that was at one with itself. So I remember that, but I also remember the process we went through to make it work. And Ron was a great practical designer, and he'd worked with Jack Brabham, obviously, and so on. So I liked that. Now, I another one's an odd one, but we got a... It was at Darlington Motor Speedway, and I was raised in a Ford Thunderbird run by Derek Cope. Derek Cope won the Daytona 500, I think, in 1919. He was running a team, and I knew Derek very well. And so driving it was a Ford Thunderbird at Darlington, and we just got this fantastic balance. It's a 1.3-mile track, a D-shaped, with big banking, and yet even then with the car, we were lapping just shy of a 160-mile-an-hour average on a 1.3-mile track, and with a D-shape, so when you came out of turn two, it squared up a bit, and the car just needed to change direction there. And I still remember that day and how good that car was, and it was really fast. But there are others, of course, you're looking for a balance and all sorts of things, but those two stick in my mind.
Did you know at the time how great the F3 car was? Or was it a case of over the next few decades, you sort of... The more cars you drove that weren't as good as it.
No. And actually, it's a funny point that, because you get that car and we're sitting on the front row, and it's a great car. And in say 1980, you go a few years later, and if you drive the same car, and I did actually test it, and now of course you're testing it for somebody that's racing it, and now it's a second off the pace. It's a shocking car, you know, and yet it's the same balance. It's because everyone else had moved on. So I think when you think it's a great car, that's only relative to how the opposition are doing, how you're doing compared to everyone else. This was a fantastic car. Look at, we saw a similar thing with Grosjean at the beginning of last year. He's driving the Haas, he's doing the Sauber thing from the year before, where they're running fifth, sixth, and great results. He gets out of that car after the first race or two. So this is the best car I've ever driven. This was the best Formula I've ever driven. And he talked to him like 3 months later, you know, and it's down the grid, you know. It's there was the actual opposite of what he thought.
Yeah.
So it was the same car.
I remember when I very first started racing very badly, and I came into the pits after the race. My dad was waiting there, and he said, "So, you know, how's the car? Is it all okay? Like understeer, oversteer? Have you got anything like that?" I said, "No, it was really good. Actually, it was really good." And he just said, "It's probably because you weren't going fast enough." And sure enough, it was. As I sort of learned, went faster and faster. And then you got chronic understeer on the way in. You got, you know, all this. So you started noticing these things. But that was because I was so rubbish. it was a wonderful car.
It's a very familiar story that. And your driver will say that when they've come before, they've seen where they are on the grid. Yeah, no, it's good, it's good. And then the time, eighth. Yeah, it had a bit of understeering. And then really hard to, you know, the story changes.
Right, we've got a question here from Jane Eyes. Hey, Rob, you have a unique perspective on what it takes to be on the F1 grid. Tell us, who is the best of the new young driving talent coming through your door at the moment and why?
Well, clearly it's Callum Ilott. because I believe Jane Myers happens to be his mother. But I'm told that actually Callum is a very talented guy. He's a bit of a James Hunt character, and overcooked it a bit at Poe on the weekend. He was, I think, the lead and crunched. But he's very, very fast, got dropped by Red Bull, and then was part of it, but then that happens to most people. And then he's, you know, picked it back up again, and I think he's got real talent. And there, Jack Aitken and GP3, yeah. He's a very, very talented driver. That's of the British ones. There's others. Jake Hughes is looking promising. And then, you know, you get into Formula 2. I love Artem Markelov. I think he's a very, very talented driver. For case of doing just that lap, he can do it. He had a bit of trouble getting off the line at the last race. He was sitting there on that pole position, and then right. I think he was about ninth by the time he got to the next corner. There's a lot of very, very talented drivers out there, but... of those coming through, and because I'm leaving some people out here whom I no doubt know very well, but but it's clearly got to be Callum.
Excellent. Well, Jane, hopefully that answers yours. Non-biased response there. One here from Andy Bliss. From your days in F3, who do you regard as the other drivers who should have made Formula 1 and didn't? Were there quite a few names from your F3 days that you thought, you know what, these guys have got what it takes and didn't?
And I think most that looked like they could got there. I think Mike White was a good driver, South African driver. Mm. I had some battles with him in the March. He sadly just passed away recently. I thought he was very, very talented, but I believe that most of those, I don't recall coming across anyone going, that's better, because the group I was doing there was with Prost or Piquet or Warwick or Johansson, Nigel Mansell.
It was a talented bunch, wasn't it?
It was a good bunch of people. De Cesaris, and I have a great shot at home from one of the races, and it's me in front of Prost, Mansell, and Boots, and I'm thinking I must have taken a wrong turn here somewhere. Now none of us were happy in that race, because I think it was De Cesaris or something won it, but so we were just battling around in Formula 3, but all the I think the good ones got there anyway, and I didn't, because I was just too, I never organised any sponsorship, I never did anything. I just drove the car, got off the banana boat from New Zealand and you could, and that was it. I didn't even think particularly that money was part of it, you had enough to keep going.
Yeah.
That was it.
I know, it's always been the case, hasn't it? It's not just now, but money's always talked.
Yeah, I talked to Marlborough, actually. The guys from Marlborough.
That would have worked out very well.
Well, I would have thought so, yeah. but it turns out, I didn't realise then that all the budgets came mostly from the countries that they were in, and they said, Rob, we sell like 10 packets of Marlborough a year in New Zealand. So
all the more reason to sponsor me.
Well, I suppose yes. Of course, yes. I didn't forget to say that. But so it's a Marlborough thing. But I think they do pool it, because I had to do... I went out to work out to select who was going to be the driver for the Indy Lights team in the early 90s, and Marlborough backed, and so I had to go through seven or eight drivers at Phoenix at the Firebird, this raceway, and so we went through, and finally we got down to two drivers. They're driving Indy Lights for Steve Horn, the Tasman things. The big boss from Marlborough, New York, a woman, was there sitting at Phoenix, and then said to all the other countries, right, your driver's not getting the drive, so you have to contribute to the Marlborough budget for these two drivers.
I just wanted to talk about rallying for a bit. And it's such a specific discipline. And I think people sort of might think, well, you know, people are coming along to sort of see you about tarmac rallies, but that's not the case. It's also about gravel. And I think Chris Meek's been to see you, Hirvonen. And how do you coach about sort of coach rallying when you didn't rally?
I did a rally.
You did.
Oh, I did.
Sorry,
a rally.
Sorry, stupid me.
Is it not on the list?
I think it must have not printed off the third, fourth, or fifth pages of your.
It was the most frightening thing I'd ever done. It fogged, all day. It was the Lakeland stages.
Okay.
And Vauxhall, oddly enough, had a guest car, Nova. So this has got to be, how long is that? 30 years ago, something. Yeah. And it was so foggy that you couldn't see anything. And Colin Wilson, who's was a good co-driver, drove with Auricula, he was my co-driver. We're coming over a brow. You couldn't see anything left, right, for, you know, I'm in fourth gear, and I go fourth to third, you know. And he said, you know, Penty Auricula, he would have gone from fourth to fifth there, not fourth. but once you could see, I was all right. Yes, you're talking to a great rally experience.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, this is a stupid question.
Well, no, I'll accept your apology.
I apologize profusely then. But maybe if I try and phrase that differently, how do you pass on your wealth of rallying experience to the likes of Hervenen and Meek?
Indeed, yeah. It started actually as a tarmac type thing. That's where people were saying, well, you know what, they've got these tarmac things, that's a bit like, you know, probably touring cars or something. So that's what started it doing. And again, it's not so much about car control or left foot braking or anything like that. It's still, you want to keep the car as straight as you can. Now, you've got to have car control. You've got to, you know, sit there with the thing on opposite lock, and they slide in the snow and they do bits and pieces like that. But the fastest way is still the most boring way, and I really say so. I was with Pro Drive, I think, we had the Subarus, and we went to an off-road place. I thought, right, now let's time this. Chris Atkinson, I think Solberg was part of it, but I think this was Chris Atkinson, who's a very good Australian rally driver. And said, let's time this, let's get to this hairpin here, and we'll go in there, we'll be Colin McRae. And you go, full opposite, around we go, we time it. And then we'll take a racing line wide end. Now we'll use the handbrake here, doing this stuff here. We really got into this. And in the end, we thought, just down, around the corner, with no particular line, just following the thing, and out, and very little wheel spin, and then off we went again, and it was fastest. You know, and so then we realized that this stuff is working on the gravel as well. You still want short corners, you still want traction, you still want to be able to slow the car down, not too brutally, so that it doesn't lock up, and you just get used to doing it. So it's turned out, I mean, most of them show up, you know. Hervenen did lots of days, Hayden Padden, Andreas Mikkelsen was over recently, he's very, very good. And Pontus Tiedemann is becoming, and he's in the level down one, but he's still getting 10th overalls and winning his classes and things like that. And there's, most of them, Alfon Evans turned up as part of an MSA day and so on. Yeah. I've done quite a lot with Malcolm Wilson's drivers as well. Yeah. Mika Hervenen turned up a lot. We got a lot of days. And also, we'd go out in his car sometimes. I went and did a special stage with Mika.
Really? How was that?
It's all right, yes. It was in France. We were there for a couple of days, and we just sat there. Well, Mikko, did the stages so we could see it in real life. Malcolm kept saying, go in the car, we'll bring the Ford down to Bruntingthorpe, you know. And I said, I don't need it, Malcolm. It's all right. You know, we'll bring it down. So, you know, so we'd have little goes and that. And then you'd see things. You'd say, well, look, you know, it's pretty jolty with this gear shifts and bits and pieces. So it was
quite interesting. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Because you use a Vauxhall.
Vauxhall Astra.
Yeah. And I was sort of mentioning, obviously, these, you know, high-profile Formula 1 drivers turning up to Bruntingthorpe, but then getting into a Vauxhall Astra as well.
I know.
Why the Vauxhall Astra?
It's just such a great car. They don't break down, you know. They're faster than people think. And, I just love them. I used to say years ago that if I was a doctor, you know, working in there, in Scotland or somewhere, and they're really, really in the outward areas there, and the snow and the rain and the bits and pieces, and you had to get the job done, I've taken a Vauxhall, because you rely on them. You know, they're tough. They're tough as all boots.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're fast.
I'm now sort of nervous about asking whether you've any done any motorbike racing, because you probably have, and I just haven't got it on the list. With rally drivers, sports car drivers, you'll have bikers coming soon. Do you watch bike racing?
I do, and what's interesting about that is that we obsess with the rate of weight transfer, that first 5% of any input that we know weight's transferred, the nose goes down, it's down, or turn the car and it's leaning to the left, it's transferred. But it's very hard to measure the first 5% of that, which, you know, the first 2.5% is about 0 to 50k, and the second 2.5% about 50 to 200. That'd be through braking or steering, and if you can see it, what is the value of it? If you're trying to look at it digitally, you know, it's hard to see, and but when we're in the car, we can feel it, and it's weight transfer. When I say to people, if you want to see weight transfer at work, watch a motorbike race, because they're coming up, they're doing, they're lifting up, they're going this way, they're, you know, they're sitting the other side, they're leaning before they get to corners, and it's a great exercise in understanding weight transfer is critical. All hidden in a racing car, you just don't see it, and it's measured digitally. And then, is there a value in it? People not sure that there's a value. Well, we now know there is. And there's mathematical models being built, and bike racing is a great way to look at that. But no, I mean, John Surtees would come up quite a bit, because unfortunately with Henry, I was training Henry, and it was great having John Surtees in the back of the car. Really? You know, he would sit there, and he was very, very good. So there's a bike race that's been, but not for that reason. Yeah. I think when Valentino Rossi came up, he was going to do a rally super stage, and it was about the time he was going. It wasn't anything to do with bikes.
Yeah, and was it the Monza rally?
That's right, the super stage,
which he won.
And we practiced up at Bruntingthorpe just a little bit.
Mm.
We may have set the track up a little similar to the Monza one.
it might have looked identical. it's got a question here from Valentin.
Valentin?
It's something that I'm... No, it's without an E.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I know you did very well.
Yeah, Valentin. Don't make me nervous about pronunciation as well, Rob.
No, I'm sorry, Ed. I'm sorry.
So he said, in equal cars, regardless of car behaviour, unbalanced, oversteer, etc., on Spa, Suzuka and Monaco, who would win? Vettel, Alonso, Hamilton, Ricciardo, Verstappen, maybe Kimi or even Hülkenberg? I think it's a question that I sort of wanted to ask, but with a slightly different angle, in terms of who do you view as the quickest? Because you always hear Hamilton, Alonso, Vettel as kind of the fastest guys in Formula One, or the most complete drivers. What are your thoughts?
We're assuming some imbalance here, I think, in that question, because if people fiddle and faddle and get that ultimate car, Vettel can be world champion
four
exactly.
times. So yeah,
if it's not quite right, Danny Ricciardo's going to end Vettel's career.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So it's so we're assuming. I would think.
But then they have different styles and like. Right.
So let's say mixed conditions, a bit of damp. Maybe we can paint a bit of a picture. So it's mixed conditions. It's a bit damp. The car understeers on one corner. It's a bit tail happy on the through Pu'er, and you know all those things. Not quite right.
Yeah.
But pole positions there. Now they're all great drivers, but you'd probably, if you were tying a hand grenade around someone's neck and pulling the pin and taking a bet on who's going to get, who would you really put your money on to see who's going to get the furthest before it blows up?
phrase I've ever heard.
I would think you would go Alonso, Verstappen, Hülkenberg.
Really?
A broad based.
And Hamilton not even on the podium, as it were.
I think that's so cruel, because obviously he'd be a great driver, but he would be, he's one of the most skillful drivers. They're all skillful. Kimi works right, you know, because Kimi's done rallying. Not, he didn't actually win, but he loves it.
He did it to a pretty good level.
He did a very good level, yeah. But I think if we're sitting there and say, right, who is your money going to be on? You really, really, no prejudice. I mean, I'm hugely biased with Kimi and so on. But, and he has a lot of affection for him, you know, so everyone would want him to do well. But I think you'd look at, it would have to be a more broad-based driver that will muscle it.
Yeah.
And somehow you think that Verstappen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Alonso, Verstappen, Hülkenberg. I would do that, but I don't want to be cruel to the others who can all win. But having, you know, you get a feel for people.
Yeah.
Not for Lewis, of course.
there's a question here from Piers that is sort of like this, but kind of extends it a bit. Who would be the most naturally talented driver you've coached over the years?
Well, there's a few. Most of them, we're working with some of the best drivers in the world. And in terms of natural talent, I put Marco Andretti up there. and I talked to Mario about this as well. He is a truly gifted car control driver. When he first started coming, I'm going, look, Marco, the IndyCar Championships, you know, they've got tarmac on the track now. You know, it's not a dirt track championship. We don't need, you know, there's all of this now. So that's the squaring up. But he has a great gift. He's a greatly gifted driver in a different environment, I know, and doing that. So, but I believe when I think of a natural driver. And there are, yeah. I mean, look, we've got hundreds, got half the Formula One field or more, you know. So yeah. we're talking best drivers in the world. So it's, but I would, I'm a fan of Mark. And when you sit with them, you know, you're sitting with them. You know, and you're doing laps after laps after laps. It's a database that builds up, and there's something in your bones and something in your blood that says, yeah, this is the guy that if we're in trouble and we're going to the corner there, that I would back.
Really? Mm. So not me then.
And I was going to say, did he say drivers, didn't he? Or did he say driver?
Yeah, sorry, journalists.
Drivers, so plural. Yeah, yeah. Well, of course. The next one up, the Ed Foster standard, is well remembered.
Is it how much do you think is down to the natural talent from with someone like Marco Andretti, and how much is down to opportunity? Because if you take someone like Hamilton, the amount when he arrived in Formula One, he had done so many testing miles that actually he was I think arguably the best prepared Formula One rookie there's ever been and almost ever been since. So if someone else with, you know, maybe less talent or something had a similar opportunity to him and had the same amount of drive, surely they would have got almost the same distance, if you see what I mean. I mean,
you are right about that, especially when you said almost. You could give that opportunity to 1,000 people, and they would never have gotten near. Lewis was worthy of that indulgence, and then you think, well, not as naturally gifted, but massively determined, Nigel Mansell, who. Now, Jim Clark was twice world champion, having done about the same number of races that Nigel did before he won a Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And so, fairly similar numbers there. And I raced against Nigel a lot. He was always good, hard driver, always fast. But you wouldn't have, say, in the 70s, we're racing around, and of the two British drivers, you'd see, say, Derek Warwick and Nigel Mansell. You wouldn't have put Mansell ahead of Warwick. In terms of natural talent, you know, you would not. Now, circumstances led, and Nigel's determination was just unbelievable, and I think that's the example that he came through, and when he finally got the right car, and at the right time with the right amount of years of preparation, if you like. 75 Formula One races.
Yeah.
You know, then he came good. So that can happen. And by the way, but Mansell did become a very gifted driver. And we spent a bit of time, we did a day in 1993 when we had won the World Championship and he was in America. So he and I went to Elkhart Lake, Road America, road car. And we just did, you know. And I was sitting there with him then and I thought, complete opposite of his personality and felt different to when I was racing against him, and he was really, really subtle, really gifted,
really
great relationship with the surface. And I was sitting there thinking, this is impressive. This is the complete opposite.
Because when you think about Mansell's career, you don't think about someone who is very like finesse. Exactly. That's
exactly. But I think his personality was one thing. His determination, you know, all that stuff. It's one thing. But he had definitely evolved. And I was sitting with him there and thinking, this guy, and this is 1993, this guy is really gifted driver. But I think that was an evolution.
Yeah. Is that the sort of the 10,000 hours argument?
Yeah, and without, we weren't a bit too hard on Nigel. He was fast when he started. He was one of the people. There were many others as well. But he went that extra little bit that got him to the point where, you know, you would say, well, there was Senna and Prost, and then that fraction behind that would have been Piquet, Mansell, you know, that fraction there. But he got awful close.
Why does Piquet always get? I always think he gets quite short change because he's multiple world champion, and yet he's never sort of mentioned in the same breath as some other drivers.
Yeah, and I shared the garage with him, you know, back in the 70s at Rell. We our Formula 3 cars were in the fiberglass shop. And you never wanted to be the first back from the race and put in your car in first because it wasn't sealed at the end of the fiberglass. You were on the stones. And so the last guy would get to park his car on the concrete. And so we'd be hovering around to be last in the garage. And yeah, so he obviously saw a fair bit of him. He won the championship. I was fourth. but he won. And I think he was a really gifted, talented driver and a real thinker. I was talking to Ron Turnack. Now about it, actually, not long ago, 10 years ago, and he was saying it's difficult to really rate Piquet. Now he knew Piquet well because we're both at the Ralt factory, you know, doing that. He said, but his car was so worked on. You know, he'd sit lower in the car, and they had lightened this, they did that. He had a spare car, and all that. But nevertheless, when you're out there racing with someone, you can tell that this guy was a very talented, finessey type driver who could absolutely was truly opportunist, you know, never missed an opportunity to do something well either with the car. And now I think maybe he was quite offensive about Nigel Mansell, but
get on that well,
and his wife as well, and I don't think that helped him. And he Nigel was a British favourite, and so in a way Piquet was the enemy. And and remember listening to Nelson when he won the title in 87, he said, you know, you look around the Williams garage, no one's happy, you know. No one's happy. They want Nigel to do this. And I think that's the view that's taken largely in Britain. I think if you go to South America, he's a triple world champion, and he was a very, very talented and gifted driver, and I would definitely put him up there. So I think some of it's to do with this, but he's a practical joker, as well, and he was sort of funny, but he could be quite cruel with his wit, you know. And I think maybe that people thought, but I think if you get away from Britain, and other people will have a different view of that. It could be partially that because he was quite cruel about Mansell, and also won the title. People felt mounted, and that may colour up. I may be wrong.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm absolutely not disagreeing. I think that's probably hit the nail on the head. We've only got a few minutes left, so I'm going to try and squeeze in a couple more questions.
Right, yes.
So I've got one here this is from Ray in Toronto, Canada.
Hello, Ray.
He's sent in loads of questions, so thanks so much for that, Ray. But I'm going to focus just on one. He wants to know how you rate Van Dorn. And he seems to be having a bit of a hard time at the moment, because certainly up until the start of this season, he was the next big thing.
Van Dorn, I haven't changed my mind there. I believe he is a future champion. He has definitely lost out to Alonso at the moment, but he's a great driver in the very early stages. I'd liken him to Jochen Rindt a while ago. Now, I think that's okay because we think of Jochen Rindt as the world champion in 1970 and battling with Stewart in 69. But in his first season in Formula 1, he was outqualified by Bruce McLaren a lot. He didn't even qualify for the Monaco Grand Prix in 65. He was firmly outqualified by John Surtees in the Coopers in 66. Yeah. There was this chunk between those two that there is between Alonso and Van Dorn now. 67. He was about even Stevens with Rodriguez and Cooper. This is Rindt, you know. But of course, he was winning in Formula 2 as well. So we had that measure. We knew he was great, but he was not faster than Rodriguez. He was slower than Bruce. He was slower than Surtees. And just later, when he got in, he had Graham Hill as a teammate, 69, you know, in the car, in the Lotus 49. He became, you know, a challenger to Stewart, generally.
Yeah.
And nice. So we view Jochen Rindt, and Jack Brabham thought he was better than Jim Clark. Rindt. Now we view Jochen Rindt in the way we do. I still think it's early days, so let's give it a few years.
Do you think there's an element of the likes of Lewis Hamilton, Carlos Sainz, maybe Max Verstappen, slightly skewering what people think about Formula One drivers when they first start? Because, you know, mentioned just before how well prepared Lewis was, Verstappen's obviously a very special talent, but immediately was on a par, if not beating his teammate. Do you think that kind of small group of drivers have slightly ruined it for the likes of Stoffel Van Dorn, who's just as talented, but not coming in with so much preparation as Lewis, who immediately, not immediately, but started beating Alonso?
I think that it will that he'll evolve you, but that has always happened, that instant Grand Prix thing. When Jody Scheckter came in, poof, suddenly an instant driver. When Nelson Piquet came in after a couple of early races, he was out there out qualifying Niki Lauda, instant driver. Now Emerson Fittipaldi did win in his first few races, but he finished first there at Watkins Glen. You know, the Surtees was like 45 seconds ahead and what have you. You know, I think Emerson evolved. You know, that by the time we got to 72, 73, he had evolved into the driver that he was. And I'm ignoring the first win in 1970 because I don't want to say it was inherited. It was great, but you know, there were circumstances there, and so I think he evolved a little bit. And I think that'll be the same. So yes, you're always comparing it to that, but give it 2 or 3 years, because we make so many quick judgments now. You know, that's in, that's out, and that's better. And we know certain drivers are going to stay roughly where they are. You know, but having sat with all of these guys, Stoffel, I think, has definitely got it. And I'd also put Danny Kvyat in a similar thing. He's been popping really up lately, and he's a real thinker as well. But I, the point about the Stoffel. Yes, but let's just give it
some time.
Give it some time.
Yeah. Right, before final question, I'm going to actually pass over to Karun, who's got a sort of two-parted question for you. Mm-hmm. One is, pick one. You have to give up coffee or smoking. And the second part of the question is, when are you giving him a job?
Ah, right. Okay. Well, definitely it would be a coffee.
Yeah. You've had tea today.
I had tea today.
I was very disappointed after this. Yeah, I saw this question come in.
Indeed. So now, the smoking, my one small pleasure in life, Karun. I mean, you wouldn't deny me that, surely. And
well, if he's asking for a job, I don't think he can.
No. He's listened for it. Actually, the thing is, when we were up there the other day, we're doing the Channel 4 thing up there, and Karun was driving. And his memory, I said, "Oh, I think it's some sort of an illness you've got. It's brutal. I mean, the his powers of recollection are extraordinary, and so I think he's got a real gift there. And so therefore, okay, we talked about this at the beginning. Who could take it over? Karun, the job is yours. Bruntingthorpe, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning."
Right, well, there we go. Look at that, it's a podcast and a job offer. Right. Who would have thought?
All right.
Rob, thank you so much for coming down. It's been absolutely fascinating. I'm sure we could have carried on talking for many more hours. You've got more important things to be doing.
Not at all, no. Yeah, it was terrific. Thank you so much
for coming in. Alan, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.
For recording this and making it sound a little bit better than we do in real life.
Correct.
We'll be back next month for another talk show. And we'll see you then. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for watching. Bye-bye for now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.